Well, good day and welcome to another episode here of the Disaster Podcast. I'm your host, Jamie Davis, the Pod Medic, and we've got a full boat today. And by full boat, I mean we actually were talking about a rafting trip before we started this call today. So we'll get into a little bit about what I meant by that. But before we can get into the rest of the show, we've got to bring on Sam Bradley, the awesome co-host that always seems to pull things together for our excellent topics every week. How you doing, Sam?
I'm good, Jamie. I guess I'm a little better than you are this week. You're kind of fighting the bug, so we'll be gentle on you tonight. And yes, this will be fun. We have a whole raft full of doctors here, that most of which you're probably familiar with if you listen to the show at all. We got Dr. Seth, Dr. Ben, Dr. Chris, and Dr. Sarah Francis, and we'll get around to introducing them a little bit better in a bit. But first, we have our Kyle with, we're trying to decide what to do with the weather, but so we thought we'd look at the Christmas forecast. What do you think?
Well, Sam, as I guess one of the non-doctors on the show tonight, good evening, everyone. As far as looking ahead at the Christmas forecast, things are going to pick up for the Northeast and the Pacific Northwest with some active weather on the way. So heavy rains in store this coming weekend for the Northeast, and for the Central Appalachians, some more heavy snow. And looking at the Pacific Northwest, you're going to have heavy snow in the Cascades as well as the very northern Rockies, and some heavy rains down near sea level on the shoreline. As far as things go in Colorado, however, looks like we may just get a bit of a white Christmas if we're lucky here, as the storm pattern picks back up starting Christmas Eve day. And for D.C. and those areas, it looks like you're going to stay pretty dry as far as things go. So it's not looking like a white Christmas for D.C. and those folks in the Northeast necessarily, unless you head up into the mountains. So that's a little bit of a look at the Christmas forecast. Sam, back to you.
Well, I know these guys are interested in what happens in the Appalachians, and I'll explain that later. Kyle, by the way, is not only our meteorologist, but he is an EMT plus, you might say, that does a lot of ski patrolling, and he does dispatch up in Aspen. So in case you're wondering where he comes from. So Seth, why don't you give a quick update or a quick bio on your team out there?
Yeah, I'd be delighted to. And thanks again for having us on the show. So many of your listeners may be aware that we run a wilderness medicine and wilderness EMS training program called the Carolina Wilderness EMS Externship here in Burke County, North Carolina. And we bring students from around the country for 1 month into our area to train them in wilderness EMS. And everyone on the call right now as a guest is affiliated with this program. And it's where the genesis came for the concept we'll be talking about today. So Ben Abo was a co-founder and pilot extern in 2011 and is famous on the show, actually kind of famous everywhere, and now is an EMS and emergency physician in Florida. And Chris Davis is also a former extern, now forging new paths as the first wilderness EMS fellow in the country at Wake Forest University, in a really innovative program that merges an EMS fellowship and a wilderness medicine fellowship into the first combined hybrid of its form. And Sarah Francis is also a former extern, now completing emergency medicine residency in the wilderness of New York. I think in the Bronx, Sarah Francis, if I'm right about that. So really wide varieties of experiences all coming together to talk about an exciting topic today.
Well, speaking of credits, I believe you got a new one here recently, did you not? Something about a master fellow of the Academy of Wilderness Medicine, like the only one, the first one?
Yeah, I think you may be referring to the Adventurers and Explorers Guild, which is an Australian-based organization that it's like an international, multidisciplinary, professional community of people who like to go to strange places and subject themselves to strange things. So I think everyone on this call falls into that category for sure. So thank you. Yes, that was a cool recognition to get, and I think everybody on this podcast today equally falls into the category of adventurer and explorer for sure.
On some level, certainly. And I hate to disappoint the audience, but we're not talking about snakes today. We actually have a much... Ben's probably relieved, even though he likes snakes a lot. But actually, we're going to have a... You guys came up with an article that kind of turned my 40 years of being in and teaching an EMS on its head. But not very far into the article, I realized that kind of what you were talking about is what I really have been doing all of these years. And we're talking about safety third. So first of all, how did you guys come up with the idea of even writing an article about this? Seth, you can take it or throw it to somebody else.
Yeah, I'd love to hand the proverbial mic over to Sarah Francis and Chris, who are both on a raft on the Ocoee River, talking about exactly these topics. And Chris and Sarah Francis, maybe you can talk about the genesis of this idea.
Absolutely. I'd love to kind of kick this off. It's you know, we've all seen out there kind of in the popular media and on Facebook and stuff, T-shirts with people with like their hand cut off saying safety third and stuff like that, kind of a tongue in cheek sort of thing. And, you know, I'd been familiar with the phrase from, you know, some one of our friends and another one of our fellow externs had done lots of medical support for the Burning Man festival out there in Nevada. And they kind of used that as their maxim, that safety third, and this idea of like, Seth, what is the exact terminology they use of just self-reliance? How do they describe that as?
Yeah, this is Burning Man's radical self-reliance.
Yep. Radical self-reliance, which I kind of love the terminology. But, you know, and we'd kind of thrown that that term around. But, you know, as we're getting on the river there with Sarah Francis, I think we had kind of sort of tongue-in-cheek sort of said safety third, you know, as we're about to go rafting. But, you know, then we started to talk about it, one thing to a led to another, and we realized, like, you know, maybe this isn't so tongue-in-cheek, in fact. Like, maybe this is just a better way to look at what we're doing because, you know, many times, like, having come up through the outdoor industry guiding and being a climbing guide and things like that, you know, I've kind of commonly been familiar with this concept that like what we're doing just inherently isn't safe. Like you can't call rock climbing safe. You can't call, you know, whitewater rafting safe. You know, you can't call, you know, going to a fire safe, but it's worth doing nonetheless, you know, and we try to do it as safely as we can. And that's just kind of where this idea came out. It's like, gosh, maybe that there is something to this. Maybe safety third isn't just a joke. Maybe it's actually a better way to think about it. So that's kind of where the whole concept came up. And as we started digging into it, we realized we weren't the first people to think of this. And, kind of came across Mike Rowe, the sort of famous Mike Rowe of Dirty Jobs. And he had actually done an entire episode of Dirty Jobs about safety third. And if you kind of search around on the internet, and I can hardly do him justice. I mean, Mike Rowe is one of the, you know, great articulate guys you'll see out there. But he kind of describes his experiences on Dirty Jobs where he's just constantly surrounded by this idea of safety first. And every time he goes into some just utterly hazardous, you know, factory or something in industry where people are doing these things that are just obviously very dangerous, you're just surrounded by all these safety first, your safety is our first priority signs everywhere. And he realizes that it was just seemed kind of ridiculous because there was just nothing safe about it. And that he kept getting hurt. And whenever he got hurt, it's because he was, you know, not paying attention or thought maybe someone else was looking out for him more than he was. So so he kind of said that their crew started saying safety third as this idea that like they just needed to say something to kind of turn this whole concept upside down and to remind each other that their safety was really only on them and that no one else was looking out for them. So we kind of took that concept and ran with it and thought, gosh, this really seems to strike a chord for all of us in emergency services and EMS and fire and rescue. And it's kind of that was the sort of the genesis of the entire concept.
Yeah, Chris, I actually pulled a phrase from the article. speaking of micro, it says Mike and his crew started using the phrase safety third to remind each other that safety was ultimately their individual responsibility and was more complex than an absolute first priority. So that kind of makes sense given what you were saying. And the first topic you actually sent me was safety first and the difference between industry, manufacturing, et cetera, and rescue. So you're kind of taking that concept from that dirty jobs scenario and translating it into the EMS world, correct?
Absolutely. It's, you know, it kind of gets to what we figured out was the kind of the heart of the matter, you know, is what it comes down to is why do we go to work every day and why do we leave the station and go to these calls when it sounds like, you know, many of us that have been in any kind of emergency response, you're getting dispatched and you're hearing this information come in as you're going to the call. And it just sounds like the world is ending and things are burning down and people are running away screaming. And yet you're on the way there. So that, you know, that certainly doesn't seem like, wow, this is safety first. You know, nothing about that seems like safety first. You know, the safest thing would be to not go to this terrible disaster. So so that kind of throws a whole wrench in this idea that safety's first. So, you know, that's kind of where it all starts, I think.
Good point. Sarah Francis, you have some thoughts behind that?
Yeah, I think everything that Chris is putting out there is so true. And I think that part of our conversation started because we realized we had different risk tolerances personally. I'm, you know, very comfortable with water rescue, but I don't like it very much. And so I don't train in it as much as Chris. And so being out there kind of on the water and kind of understanding the river, Chris is just a lot more willing to try different things than I was. And so I think that was a big part of the conversation was like, where are these boundaries that we set for ourselves and where are the boundaries that are set for us in the industry standard as well? So that was a big topic of conversation.
So here's another phrase I pulled. No scene is fundamentally safe for first responders, and no scene can ever truly be secure, but first responders have a duty to act, balanced by an obligation to assess relative risk. I think that term relative risk makes a lot of sense. Seth, you want to take that or give it to Chris?
Yeah, I'd be happy to run with it, and I'm sure Chris will have thoughts to add. Really, yeah, relativist risk is very key to it. The idea of risk mitigation, the concept that we're really doing a disservice to our students and our practitioners by presenting the idea that you can check for scene safety and then walk away from that idea. And what we're really talking about is risk mitigation throughout an operation. And that's a much more sophisticated and, frankly, tricky thing to navigate than simply saying, is the scene safe or not? What it requires, both as operators and as trainers, is to talk about what makes a scene more or less safe. And that's really, I think, what Sarah Francis is getting at with people's, you know, risk thresholds that differ between each other. And getting to talk to operators and students about that and what the characteristics are that make a scene more or less safe, what their threshold is for chucking aside their duty to act for their own personal safety, is a discussion that we completely jettison if we simply argue that the scene is safe or not.
So Chris wants Ben to join him talking about the idea of personal risk tolerance and how it's different for each individual. Ben, you want to start on that one?
Yeah, so it's funny. And it's sad to say, here I am. I'm coming right now from the paramedic graduation, and these 29 individuals I just watched do the National Registry practical exam, and they come in and they put on their gloves and they just put their hands in the air and they say, "Scene safe BSI," and forget about it. And really, you know, is it it's safe-ish? It's safe enough? Safe for now? And everyone, as Sarah Francis alluded to, really has a different take on things. And some of us go what consider above and beyond, and some of us just do what we think we're supposed to do, whether it's because it's our job or because it's just the right thing to do as a person that whether we have certain skills. When I go to work and I'm out responding on calls and things like that, you have to learn to think about what your own personal boundaries are and what you're willing to do and kind of see with other people. I know when certain things I can rely on others to help protect me, but really everyone has a different threshold of what they're willing to do, whether they're on duty or off duty. And I think, personally, I've been pretty lucky, especially during that month-long externship with Seth. We've had quite a number of calls that were quite out there over the mountainside, one of those first nights or 4.5 hours under a truck, and the I-beams and everything, and different people at different comfort levels with that. And then personally, when I was off duty a couple of years ago, I had an incident that I witnessed when I was on vacation in New York City, which I pray for Sarah Francis' safety third and first every day when she's riding the subway up there, because someone fell into the tracks. And there's people that will just take pictures. There are people that will stand there. There are people that run away. And there are people that do something. And for that, I chose to do something. And what it comes down to is you don't have to expect everyone to do it, but just recognizing and thinking of your own thresholds and different people do different things. Everyone can define things with words, but to define it with actions and kind of really hold yourself to it is another thing.
Kind of to piggyback on this, Ben, I think this brings up a really great point here is that we shouldn't expect everyone to do the same thing, because it, what anyone's so personal tolerance is a product of their entire life experience, all their training, their value system, whether this scenario that they're facing really strikes a chord with them, that it creates some sort of personal connection. I think that for us to write blanket policies to say, to judge things in a binary situation for our, those of us that are in a supervisory role and things, is kind of walking a very fine line, because I feel like we have to give people the latitude to be able to make life-saving decisions and then not, crucify them over it the next day if things didn't turn out right, and to Monday morning quarterback that. I think it's really important to give people the autonomy to be able to, to be able to make decisions to save lives that, maybe I wouldn't have been comfortable with, just recognizing where they're coming from. But I think it's important that we follow that with real training in risk assessment and risk mitigation that goes beyond what Ben was talking about, that is just kind of throwing your hands up in the air and saying, is the scene safe, BSI? Because that's, we've already gone ahead and assumed that the scene isn't safe. We're running into an emergency. So I think that's an important part to go with all this.
I actually pulled a couple sentences relating exactly to that. Reactionary policymaking may have the unintended consequence of forcing our responders into a position where they must choose between violating a policy or taking a risk that falls within their personal tolerance and level of skill with the potential to save a life. We continue to preach safety first while simultaneously and paradoxically encouraging our personnel to normalize risk and push back past the everyday and obvious warning. And that has a lot to do with risk-reward balancing. You want to talk about that?
So I think this has been moved over to me here. So I think with the risk-reward balance, we talk a lot about comfort zones and how do we increase that comfort zone, because we can't just live within that zone all the time. We're not always going to... I mean, that would be boring to a lot of people who are risk takers. So the way that I look at a comfort zone is like I always want to be increasing that. So through training, I learn more techniques. I practice. start improving that your mindset in a different area. So I guess, Seth, we talked a lot about like how I like to train in pediatrics during the externship. I was always really nervous with pediatric patients, and I think a lot of medics are. And so I started going to all these conferences and studying in the pediatric realm and started taking all of the patients who are pediatrics. And I do that with, you know, with Swiftwater. I do that with climbing and high angle rescue. And I think that a lot of certifications are meant to just check a box and say, okay, so you know how to do Swiftwater rescue and you can go out and do it. But with the when you put yourself into that situation multiple weekends and multiple weeks, and then you go out and you do it in real life, you're going to feel a lot more comfortable and those boundaries widen quite a bit. So I think that we're just talking about widening comfort level for each individual, and each individual is going to choose what they enjoy doing every weekend, and then they'll be more comfortable in that scenario.
Well, here's another sentence I really like, and maybe you can address this, Sarah Francis. Preaching safety first is a principle from the beginning of their training, and failing to acknowledge inevitable hazards on every scene allows complacency to develop from an early age of training. So your concept on the training makes a lot of sense. But
yeah, complacency, I think, is really dangerous in our line of work. And when you think like a certification or a license is the end of your training, you finished it, you don't have to do any more. I think that that's one of the most dangerous situations that you can be in. And constantly pushing that and wanting to learn more and wanting to do the research and make that scenario safer is really important in our line of work.
Yeah, I want to see how Ben's going to talk the National Registry out of losing BSI scene safety, but we'll see what happens there. Seth, you had a comment, then we'll go to Kyle.
Yeah, two quick thoughts. One is that I think Ben and I would love to engage on national thought leaders in EMS on how to get rid of BSI scene safety. And really, I think the way to do it is just what we were describing earlier, and have a student or a test taker be forced to assess the risks of an environment. It's what we do in the real world. It's what they should be doing in a test-taking scenario. So just to hit on it again, putting on gloves and asking for a binary response of whether the scene is safe is not realistic. It's not appropriate. It misleads students, and it leads to that complacency that Sarah Francis is describing. So I think that it's really, I think it's deadly. And I think it's really important that our leaders in EMS start to recognize the degree to which this actually may be a harmful process in our education. So I think another angle to take on this too that's important is we're dismissing the idea that safety really ever should be first. And another, you know, approach to take is the interesting question of what happens when we really do privilege that. And one of the things we point out in the article is the decision recently from Penn State to ban their 98-year-old outing club from ever going outside. And what we're seeing is there are movements in our society to start taking as a literal truth what we teach, which is kind of what we want. We want the things we say to mean something. But honestly, when we're at the point where it's considered too risky to go outside and an outing club has to restrict its activities to indoor operations, is the point where I think we need to start paying attention and start looking at whether the things that we're teaching and practicing our students and our operators is actually being put into effect in real and damaging ways in a process to sterilize our lives and our ability to actually complete the work we do, which I think is really the ultimate goal that we should all have as healthcare providers.
That's true. Seth, we're going to let you go, then Chris, then Ben. Guys are stacked up here.
I was just going to chime in real quick on this, that, you know, I think that it's, you know, as we were talking about the scene safety BSI, I mean, it's I don't think it truly even privileges safety as the first thing when we do that, you know, because if you're looking at this as a binary decision point, I think that's where we kind of fail from the get-go. And, you know, we can talk about training scars and things like that, but we can look to other industries and look to law enforcement, look to the military, look to even the fire service, and they actually train risk mitigation and risk assessment as part of their scenarios. And so I would kind of challenge any other EMS administrators or training officers out there to kind of look for ways to train risk assessment and sort of situational awareness into your scenarios. And you know, that's something we started trying to do this year. One of my EMS agencies, where for our annual scope of practice exams, we had someone sitting there on the side of the scenario with a bottle of whiskey and a fake gun. And we just kind of threw that into the mix. And you know, they walked up and said, "Is the scene safe?" And we're like, "You have what you have."
And I let love them, it.
And it was just amazing just kind of seeing people real, you know, but this is not an unrealistic scenario. So, so we just kind of let that, play out and just sort of see what happened with it. And, you know, police train like this and you know, the military trains like this, and maybe it's time for us to start training like this too. So.
Makes sense. Chris.
I think Ben has something to say there.
Yeah. Well, Chris had his hand up too.
I mean,
go ahead, Ben.
The first thing that I was going to say is that exactly what Chris just addressed. So pretty much first off, ditto, and well said there. You know, we have these other industries. We have a lot of crossover depending on the system or style we're in. Some are public safety, some are fire-based, some are all the above, of all of them. But, like, why not change? Why are so many stuck in this complacency of status quo? Well, this is how we've trained, and, oh, now we have to change some things just to make it safer, when really we should be training to make it more realistic so we can learn this risk assessment. When I was just deployed with USAR with some of the recent hurricanes, you know, I love one of my main safety officers from my task force, Shane Anderson. I love him to death. He's one of my brothers. But there are a lot of things based on what he was trained on as our safety officer of what's going on. I would just kind of laugh because even when we're doing training stuff and doing some little things, we need to be a little more realistic and we can't be sitting there in bubble wrap. But at the same time, going even further back in our conversation together, all of us, you know, we can't assume that everyone's going to have a certain comfort level that's going to do this and that. And when we play Monday morning quarterback, it shouldn't be critiquing where if they survived, it's well, great and we can learn this, or I would have done that, blah, blah, blah. And, oh, if someone either gets hurt seriously or even worse, dies in the line of duty, oh, well, that's because this. They should have gone into the seat. But there's this pressure to do our job however we defined it. So we really need to, as Chris is saying, work on assessing the situations, assessing our training, and taking it from there and assessing our comfort level so we can mitigate as much as possible. But in the end, there are certain things that just need to be done, and that's why we do what we do, to deliver that care to different people.
I totally agree. And we're kind of moving into the tactical operational environments as far as safety third. And I actually had a thought as I was going through these notes, but I think the first breakthrough, if you will, from that absolute scene safety, you know, you don't go in, but you do, concept was when we started looking at tactical medicine and active shooter and training RTF, which is really putting us in the warm zone. Do you think, and I'll start with Seth and any of you could grab it, but do you think that might have been a factor in changing this thinking?
Yeah, I'll defer to Ben.
We first were talking about doing and putting the article and all together. We were going through a lot of changes here in Florida that are very specific to this topic. Once, after the unfortunate incidents in Columbine, we really learned that we can't really wait. And a lot of things came into play when we started assessing and hearing about how they handled the terrorist actions around Paris and France and them creating warm zones and kind of going in, it really was really interesting. And so you have people that you come up with plans, you come up with SOPs and the rescue task forces, and with that comes expectations. So here I am in the middle of a rural part of Florida, and some are talking about, well, I'm going to start carrying my sidearm. That adds a whole new level of what the heck's going on when they're not trained. They're concealed weapon permit holders, but they're not police officers. They're not signed off. And there are others that say, well, we're going to go to this rescue task force. And some are very excited to be part of it and do the training and be part of something. But there are others that are saying, well, heck no, not unless you give me the right equipment. And the SOPs were coming out even before the equipment was being placed on all the ambulances. So how do you decide so-and-so's on duty, therefore you're expected to go in? That's really a whole lot different than what they originally signed up for. And I'm not talking about firefighters that thought they were going to be working full-time on an engine and now they got to start running EMS calls is a little different than what they may have expected. This is an entire different line of things. So that thinking needs to be put into place. And just because you add a proper helmet, a proper ballistic vest, and you give them a couple tourniquets doesn't make it safer. A huge part of it still needs to come down to training and training the right way.
Exactly. And I love this phrase from your CWEMSE, Seth. No PowerPoint presentation can impart lasting wisdom about medical care in extreme environments quite as well as spending hours providing medical care in extreme environments. And another place you talk about, you know, you can't teach much about hypothermia unless you're wet and cold. You want to comment on that?
Yeah, for sure. We're quite committed to that S.A. Quam Videre training module, or model rather, which follows the Cicero Latin quote of to be rather than to appear to be. And that really has relevance for this topic here as well, because I think really what we're all reinforcing is that questioning whether a scene is safe as a binary is appearing to do something. It's not actually doing something. So what we know is if we leave like the oral exam and we go out that afternoon into the world, we're every moment of the day we're doing risk assessments. And as healthcare providers, that's even more important. So yeah, we're committed to the idea that we want to train like we fight, so that we bleed less when we fight. And we also want to make sure that what we're training matches the realities of what's going on in the real world environment. So, this is an interesting issue for trainers. And that's what my hat is within the externship, is the idea of taking physicians and who will be future leaders in the wilderness EMS world and getting 1 month to try to train them to the best of our ability and what skills they'll need to pursue activities in that world. And we all know, just as Sarah Francis and Chris were realizing on the raft in the Ocoee, that we need to do better. We need to do a better job of how we talk about these issues. So we explored the concept and the intellectual sort of scaffolding of where safety should fall. We ended up feeling like it should fall as a third priority, which, like Chris was saying, was a little bit of a play on other safety third kind of movements, but that led us to beg the question of what was first and second.
Well, and that's exactly where I wanted to go. But first, who wants to explain PEEPS? Anybody? Well, Seth, I'll throw it back to you.
Yeah, sorry, my screen just popped off. That was my pause. So PEEPS is a publication that, or a concept that came out in a publication that Jamie Lieberman published in the Wilderness Medicine magazine, a magazine that I serve as executive editor for, so I'm really familiar with his work on this. And we've all, at least those of us in healthcare, especially the hospital-based side of it, have heard at great length and maybe become somewhat fatigued by air industry analogies for safety in our industry. And there's a bit of fatigue about that concept that running a medical operation is all that similar to launching a plane. But what we have realized is that there is a definite benefit to checklists and kind of systematically going through those risks that might be expected to come up and how to mitigate them. So what this really gets at is if we are going to tell people not to simply say that safety is the first priority, but actually do a robust analysis of what the risks are and whether they exceed or don't exceed our tolerance to continue our operation, Lieberman proposed this PEEPS checklist to avoid catastrophic failures in the work that we do. So PEEPS stands for person is the first P, and this has to do with an individual's health and well-being, and that in the sense of us talking earlier about everybody's risk management threshold or risk tolerance threshold being different, this is really assessing those elements that might impair our ability to do well. So if we haven't eaten in enough time or drunk enough time, or if we're, I think, very relevant for EMS on the 23rd hour of our 24th shift, we need to be aware of those elements and how they change our own ability to safely function in an environment. And actually this year in particular in the externship, we dug really deep into that and came up with a secondary acronym for assessing your own individual health and well-being. And then the first E is environment and conditions, which, since we're training particularly ourselves in wilderness medicine, is very pertinent. So that's the concept that you need to assess the potential for hypothermia, given the fact that it's 0 degrees outside, and how that factors into an operation. And if you just say, is the scene safe? And somebody says, it's a 0 degree weather day, and you just move on and completely ignore that element to it, you may be ignoring the most complicating factor of what happens. And I think that's true of wilderness EMS in general, is that people in hospitals or who don't experience this kind of care environment don't understand why an ankle sprain was such a huge production involving 8 different counties and 14 different teams and 8 hours and multiple vehicles. And sort of like in politics, it's the economy stupid. In wilderness EMS, it's the environment stupid. Like it's the environment that complicates much of what we do. Equipment is the next E, and that obviously speaks to the necessity to have appropriate equipment with you. A great example of this is the water safety or water rescue environment that Sarah Francis was talking about and Chris is so well trained in. And we know from Chinese data, and it's probably been replicated a couple other places, and I think it's probably pretty realistic that about 5% of drownings are would-be rescuers. And in many cases, they don't have appropriate equipment or they don't have appropriate training. So I would put those together as equipment and training to actually safely affect the rescue that you're doing. And that's not something that comes in necessarily in a safety first check, like, okay, I'm about to go rappel down to rescue this person. Is the scene safe? Yes. Okay, I rappel off the tree, but I forgot my rope and I fall to my death. So clearly equipment is a critical element to this. The second P is the partner or the team, and the recognition that very, very, very rarely are we operating as lone cowboys, and that in fact this is almost always a team operation, and we need to recognize the force multipliers we may have in our teammates, but also the safety issues that come up if there's impaired members. And then the final catch-all S is scenario, meaning the overall situational awareness of what's happening, and that's, I think, what we try to capture with is the scene safe, but inadequately so. So that would be the overall context of the care that you're delivering. So if anybody's interested in it, this is in a Wilderness Medicine magazine article by Lieberman. He's a great wilderness medicine physician and a board member of the Wilderness Medical Society and an author for Wilderness Medicine magazine. And we can generate the URL for that if people are interested.
I think that'd be great. So, Chris, if safety is third, what's first and second?
I thought you'd never ask. This is where it really started to get interesting, because you started thinking about, gosh, well, we all can agree that, you know, safety is not always the first thing, you know, that or, you know, it may be the first thing we think about it, but it's not always the most pressing issue, right? So this went around back and forth and all over the place, and I've actually given a couple of sort of seminars on this at some conferences, and we had small groups kind of work through this, and interestingly, a lot of these groups came to the same conclusion that we did, that, you know, when you stop and you think, why are we here in the first part? Why are we racing towards this disaster? What? It's because we have a mission-oriented attitude. And what we're trying to do is we're trying to accomplish a task that we have deemed to be very important. So, you know, a great way to think about this is to think about, first of all, first priority, what is our mission? Okay. And then that's where we go through our complex risk assessment of, you know, to put it in the terms of one of our recent externs who has just, he's a wordsmith, you know, even beyond that of Seth with some things, you know, which is incredible, I know, but Wooten Jones, he kind of laid this out as, is the juice worth the squeeze, which I think is a great way to think about it. So by first priority, we have to decide, first of all, is the juice worth the squeeze? How much are we willing to risk for what this mission is that we're trying to do? So number one, we have to consider, if we're going on a body recovery and it's lightning storm and we have to cross a high alpine ridge, you know, absolutely not. You know, there's no way that we would do that. But, you know, if there's someone in incredible peril, they're in a, you know, they're trapped in a vehicle that all you need to do is cut a seatbelt and pull them out and the vehicle is catching fire and there's a small child in the car seat, you know, even if I didn't have PPE, I would probably risk getting burned to go pull that child out. So it's totally situationally relevant, you know, what is our training? What is our equipment? What is the task at hand? So that's the first priority, right? Is that this is a, what is the mission and what are we willing to risk to do this mission? This is something that, you know, if anyone else has something to chime in on, certainly be my guest.
Yeah, this is. I would be the first to defer to Wooten for Wootenisms and aphorisms. This man, I worked with him for a month as an extern, and he generated like at least one a day. Like, I started just taking notes on them because I knew that if I got enough of them, I could live my life by Wootenisms. And the juice worth the squeeze is certainly one of those. And yeah, I would just like to reinforce what you're saying, that safety is a part of this concept, that the job needs to get done. So it's not disregarding the concept of safety being at the highest levels of priority, but it's not exclusive. And if we really honestly balance out what it is we're really trying to accomplish in EMS, we're trying to get the job done. And we show up to get the job done. We appreciate our partners who work to get the job done. And the expectation for society is that our orientation is to get the job done, and then we prepare and train and equip ourselves to do that. So I think just honestly speaking, that's the way that that we approach our training and our activities. But just wanted to also emphasize that safety is a part of that overall picture, because if you don't survive the action and you can't complete the task, then you haven't actually done the first step to begin with.
And Chris, one of the points you made to me was having fun and the importance of job satisfaction and longevity in the field. You want to touch on that, and maybe we'll bounce this by again as well.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, this is one of the things that, you know, at first, again, just like the other concept, you're like, you know, number one is getting the job done, right? And number two is having fun. So first of all, it's cool because it rhymes, so that's always a good thing. Also, when you get down to it, it really gets to some of the heart of some of the, you know, the stuff that is, you, we don't really want to think about much in EMS, and that's burnout, and, you know, people that, you know, don't want to go to work anymore, and that, you know, we're seeing just extremely short careers for a lot of our new paramedics. And, you know, part of that is, I think, just we're having difficulties preserving what is the point of all this. Why are we doing it? You know, it, you know, you get into your seventh chart that you're behind in, and you're, you know, charting and you know, getting written up for violating these policies that may have no point except for to try to mitigate someone's insurance premiums or something. And you start to think, you know, gosh, are we driving everyone out of this incredibly valuable profession simply for, you know, just for completely crazy reasons, and making people work too many hours and not giving them appropriate time off, and not giving them time to emotionally recover from some of these traumatic events that they're seeing. I mean, it just goes on and on. And if we can't keep these people happy and doing a great job and fired up and ready to go to work to do a great job, I mean, again, what's the point, you know? And I'm sure that somebody else has some excellent stuff to throw in here, but that's really where we started with this idea of, like, number one is we're here for a reason. You know, we're here to help people, you know, be it in, if you're in fire, police, disaster response, EMS, that's why we do it. And number two is that you've got to keep that in sight, and you've got to, at the end of the day, think that the positives outweighed the negatives.
Sarah Francis, what are your thoughts on that?
Yeah, so I think it's really important, like Chris said here, to keep that mission at the forefront. But also, you know, your personal goals and your team goals, and continuously kind of revisit those as a team. Because I think when we come into the Monday morning quarterbacking, like we were talking about earlier, a lot of times the mission of the critics may be different than the mission of the person at that time. And that, I think that adds a lot of stress to the job, because you're constantly wondering, like, what is somebody else's mission? And if you can have meetings about that, and maybe even... I remember I had a partner when I was a medic, and we would every morning go over our mission. And that was the happiest partnership that we had, and the most successful that I think that we had during my time as a medic, because every morning we would say, here's our mission. We would talk about every call. And I think that's really important, to, like, find what it is that drove you into EMS, police, fire, whatever, in the very beginning. And then try to find that every day that you're there, whether it's one patient, multiple patients, one call. Why did you get up this morning and go to work? And if you haven't found that by the end of the shift, it's time to talk to your partner and figure out, you know, maybe there was something that you missed that helped you, that can help you come to work the next day.
I love that. And I found a sentence that really illustrates that. Perhaps the main point here is mental health and personal resilience. We need to bring back those elements to this work that bring us joy. And I really agree with that. Kyle, you had a thought.
Yeah, Sam. And I think this is that sentence that you just read really sums this up quite nicely. And for me, as a professional ski patroller here in Aspen, you know, all these elements of risk and uncertainty in the job, you know, it always adds to... it adds to every single call, and it's there all the time, even if you're not thinking about it. And I think it is important, especially following those difficult calls, to be able to sit down with those folks. And as you said, if you find yourself coming at the end of the day or throughout the day and you're like, what am I doing here? Why am I doing this? You know, I even have to be reminded from time to time by some of my very good friends and colleagues that, hey, it's like, no, it's not just about this or that. It's the bigger picture. And I also come at this as well from the 911 dispatch side of things, both on call taking and as a radio dispatcher, in that every call that I take, every call that I dispatch units to, no matter how minor, you're making a positive impact in someone's life. And reminding myself and my colleagues of that, it helps us to keep pushing ahead and striving to do the best that we can for the public.
Well said, as always, Kyle. I'm going to throw this one at you, Seth, because I really like this one. Valuing risk prevention and fear over the joy of taking risks in the interest of saving lives will indeed ensure that safety is first, but it will also guarantee the death of the very soul of EMS. That's a pretty heavy statement. So you want to take that or give it to somebody?
Yes, yes, indeed. And that's a concept and a quote that's familiar, I know, to many people on this podcast and maybe also in the audience. This is drawn from the thinking of Willie Unsold, who is a 20th century mountaineer, leader in outdoor experiential education, an Outward Bound leader and pioneer, and somebody who was perhaps as or more thoughtful as anyone in the United States about risk management and the balancing of the need that we have as human beings to experience stress and growth, to learn and to grow and to evolve as individuals, with the chance that those very same pressures and incidents can cripple us or kill us. So, yeah, that line of thinking was drawn from his famous quote to a mother who asked if he could guarantee the safety of her child if that child took an Outward Bound class. And he said, absolutely not. I can't assure the safety of your child. In fact, I can assure you that the risk will be imminent and ever present. But what I can certainly promise you is the death of your child's soul if he never encounters adventures or stressors like this in his life. So that's a paraphrase, but it really, to me, speaks to some of the things that draw many of us into this line of work, is that we're there to save lives, we're there to make a difference, we're there to be put in the crucible and prove ourselves as agents of change to make people's lives better. So there's some discussion in these circles about moral injury and how much the movement away from actions that allow us to perform those services and instead direct us to do paperwork or to fill out forms or all the things that we do see as kind of destroying our souls as healthcare providers, or in a more pure moral injury kind of framework, actually force us to participate in activities that we feel like are morally inappropriate or morally repugnant. This is, you know, I think originally a military concept, which you can immediately see how that could work. I think that all this is what we have to start grappling with as we put together these issues of burnout and suicide and why we get pulled into this work and the ghosts that we generate as we go through years and years of practice in this. And how do we support people in making this as joyful a job on day 2001 as it is on day one. And so, yeah, I think that concept is very germane to that. We did a lot of work on this concept this year in the externship in terms of stress injuries. And one of the realities that I came to believe was that there's a homeostatic point where stressors are a very positive thing for human beings. So it's kind of a bell curve where at the center, if your x-axis is sort of the amount of stress that you are feeling and your y-axis of the vertical axis is how high functioning you are, it makes a big kind of dome where the very top part of the dome, you've got the optimum amount of stress, you are plugging along, you're doing great. You're on a ski patrol, it's, you know, beautiful day, you're out there, somebody's hurt, and you're doing a really important work to get them to safety, and things seem to be moving well. And I think part of what this quote gets at is, if that's sort of the highest functioning person that we can be as an EMS provider or a disaster responder, if we ratchet down that stimulus to the point where there's absolutely no input whatsoever, we've reached basically cellular death. Like, all our entire body even is based on the idea of stress and continuums and channels of ions that pass back and forth, and your heart beats because sodium potassium pumps work and they maintain disequilibrium to drive muscles. And if all that stops, that's actually death. Death is, the definition of death is equilibrium. And on the other side, if there's too much stress, which we've all kind of experienced, and too much risk, and we're overwhelmed, that's also an incapacitating state as well. That can happen on an incident. Like, if you are analyzing, you know, risk and you are completely overwhelmed in the incident, that may be the point where you say, check please. This is way beyond my my risk comfort level. But it also happens on a career level. So we can reach the point where we have saturated ourselves with so much input and so much unmitigated, uncontrolled stimulus that we no longer are high functioning. We're not in the top part of that bell curve. Really, really getting at this question of why we're doing this, how it's safe and how it's sustainable, I think is what will be very important to keep providers balancing that stimulus that keeps us all alive and keeps us loving our job with either cellular death from inactivity or, you know, overwhelming input.
So when's the article coming out on that topic, Seth? I'd like to see that.
Yes, it is. It's the overall principle there is psychological first aid. And it is a chapter in the Wilderness EMS textbook, but it's more particularly going to be, I think, featured in an article in Emergency Medicine News shortly. We've spent a lot of time this year really kind of digging into that. And it's very, very relevant for this dialogue because it ultimately, again, points out that safety, if safety is the ultimate goal and we all sit at home and do absolutely nothing at all, then we all die very, very quickly.
Right there. So, Chris, you had a thought.
Yeah, it's, really Seth covered, just about everything I was going to say there. But, I think when we want to think about what do we do with this, right, we can sit here, we can think about this and stuff. And I always like to try to have some sort of action items, whenever I talk to anybody or think about anything. And, what are things we can do? I think about it. It depends on who you are. So if you're, if you want to prevent the death of your soul, part of that is, I think, where we come back to is training. Is like Sarah Francis was talking to, is widen your comfort zone. That allows you to operate in environments, without so much stress. There are certain things about this job that we can't change. We can't change the uncertainty of the environments we operate in. We can't change the fact that when we walk into that home to take care of a little old lady that's having trouble breathing, that there could be, a crazy family member that comes out that's causes an unsafe situation. We can't change that, but we can train and we can be more prepared to deal with things both through technical skills, and also we can train to be more emotionally resilient. We can widen our comfort zone and increase our the areas in which we can operate safely, which and by doing that, being more skilled and technically proficient, that increases our ability to operate safely. Because one of the first things we can do in risk mitigation is through a high level of technical skill. That's our first line of defense. And secondly, for those of us that are kind of in an administrative or advisory or oversight role, I think just simply stopping and thinking about your providers and folks that are out there, and privileging their emotional well-being, not always playing that Monday morning quarterback, considering what's important, there, and not losing sight of the priorities of why we're actually out there. And I think that will go a really long way. And then also trying to provide folks with the opportunities to train and train well, and to train in realistic environments, and not just something that's really kind of phoned in, and make it as real as you can. And I know that takes a lot of work, and that is very difficult to provide good training. But I think if you really get down to it, just like Seth is saying, is what we're trying to do is we're trying to prevent ourselves from dying, both emotionally and physically. And I think when you think about it that way, it certainly, ups the ante a little bit for how we train. So that's kind of what I think about is what can I really do about this? And I've been trying to do that as much as I can.
Yeah, I love that too. That's preventing ourselves from dying. Well, I want to get final thoughts from all of you, but the last question here, because Jamie's letting us run a little bit long, because this is so such a fascinating topic. But Seth, what kind of reactions have you had to the article?
Yeah, I think we all steeled ourselves for a bloodbath. you know, I've taken on the backboard question, which I thought, you know, might be challenging one of the most treasured paradigms of EMS care. But that's nothing compared to suggesting that safety isn't the first priority. You know, honestly, I would love to bounce this to Sarah Francis. I could share some thoughts, but I think really she's told me about some experiences where she's sort of been on the front line talking to people. And I think, you know, how you navigate the skeptics is very important in this. And Sarah Francis, you may have some real world sort of experiences with that.
Yeah, so I think since the article came out, it's pleasantly surprised with a lot of positive feedback. But some feedback that I've had from it seems more like administrative types in the EMS and fire world, saying, well, if we start preaching safety third, then that's going to give us a lot more liability and kind of not willing to take on that risk. When we talk about, then, you know, I usually push it to, well, who are you hiring? What are their goals? Because it seems like in our line of work, we need to be hiring kind of the risk takers, the ones who are willing to go out there and train and do some training on their own as well, who want to be out there. So it's just been an interesting conversation between the people in the front lines who are kind of like, oh, yeah, safety third, and then the ones who may be paying for the first aid that may have to occur in the end, who are saying, oh, wait, hold on. Are you getting rid of all rules? No, I'm not getting rid of all rules. Actually, the rules are still very much present. We're just trying to train the teams to think differently and think, take on the responsibility themselves to be safe
and save their lives. Any other final thoughts, Sarah Francis?
No, I don't think so.
Okay. Well, you've had great things to say. Chris, final thoughts?
Yeah, I think one of the, you know, the take home points is getting really to what Sarah Francis was saying is that, you know, I've seen a wide range of feedback from this article. Was actually completely floored that it was mostly positive. Like Seth was saying, like we were, like before I put my name on this thing and put it out there, I was like, well, I'm ready for just some flood of emails and death threats and all kinds of stuff. But, you know, I think it actually really did resonate well with a lot of people. And I think the thing that I never let anybody walk away from any discussion of this, you know, either at any of my talks or anything about it, without really driving home the point that the point of this is not to go like screaming wahoo and jumping off buildings and stuff like that and throwing caution to the wind. That's not at all. I mean, I always want to leave this conversation with getting back to the reason we started it in the first place, which was because I legitimately didn't think that a safety first approach was actually the safest way to do it. So I think that taking this kind of measured approach by having, you know, a mission oriented atmosphere, preserving, you know, our emotional and, you know, emotional well-being and having, you know, a realistic approach to training actually makes us safer than if we just say scene safe BSI. And, you know, we've, you know, even gone so far as you know, I like to sort of brand this as, you know, everybody goes home. That's something that the, you know, I learned about in the fire service, is this idea that at the end of the day, everybody should go home. And we even put this on. We've made some stickers that you can get at hawkventures.com that is Solvum Reverto Domus, which is Latin for everyone goes home. It's on our stickers. I think that's the take-home point, really, is not safety first, but we want everyone to go home at the end of the day.
Oh, I love that. So, Kyle, final thoughts?
Sam, I am just blown away with the great discussion tonight. Huge thanks to Seth and the whole team for coming on. I think it's been a great discussion, and I think it's really opened a lot of eyes and a lot of minds as well, as a mindset shift, if you will, in the way that we operate as first responders and care providers in the field. So I'd love to see the discussion continue going forward, Sam, on all of our platforms that we have available to us.
Well, these guys are definitely game changers. Dr. Ben, you still out there driving to work?
Yeah, still here, about to pull up. But, you know, it was very interesting me when I came with it to see what would the responses be from people. And like Chris said, I expected a lot of backlash on certain aspects of the point. Is that it actually was very, very, very well received. And really the point is not to tell people to go and do something, but the point is to get people to talk about it and come to realizations so we can change our ways to improve, because status quo really is one of our biggest enemies. So I laugh thinking tomorrow morning after my overnight shift, I have a meeting tomorrow at one of my fire departments with the safety chief and one of the fire chiefs that I have the biggest respect for, that I've learned so much from, Chief Hillhouse. And I can't wait to get, you know, the high vis vest, the one that says safety officer for like the MCI vest. And you better believe I'm going to start pinning or duct taping and writing third on all the, the vests.
I love it.
But, it's so happening. But honestly, to rethink things through and try and put into words so eloquently as Seth and Sarah Francis and Chris have allowed it to be done, let me put it in play, because as for me, I'm also we're educators, but the EMS physician not only responding to the scenes, but overseeing and trying to mentor people and push people into a career to join us, I think is important, something to take an aspect, especially when they don't get the references. We can talk about Johnny and Roy and the heroes they were and the things they did and all, but the new generation just doesn't get that. And so having this concept that we can talk about with people, I think it's really important, so we can keep ourselves safe and do greatness out there.
Absolutely. So Seth, you get the final thought.
Yeah, I think I'm with Chris that the most important message that I want to get across is that Safety Third is actually about preventing dying. It's actually about safety. It's about a more sophisticated understanding of safety. My biggest fear coming out, it's still my biggest fear, is that God forbid we have some sort of bad incident involving our own staff. And I can see the headlines that say, you know, program that argues safety is not a priority sustains critical injury, or, you know, that's what keeps me up at night. And I think hopefully folks who've listened through this entire podcast have come to realize that, if you're thoughtful about safety, if you're thoughtful about actually mitigating risk, then what, even though the tongue-in-cheek Safety Third line is really fun and cool, what we're really talking about is how do we really intelligently manage risk. And I think that in fact presents a much more robust safety program for any organization than one that simply has a banner that says safety first.
I couldn't agree more, and I was sold on the, you know, the first paragraph of the article. So, Jamie, you've been quiet back there because I know we've had a lot of guests on, but this whole discussion's been about training and the advantage of experiential training, and that's certainly what Paragon does. So this fits nicely, doesn't it?
Absolutely, and I was thinking about this as we got in further into the discussion, because part of risk management and part of understanding where risk factors come into play is being able to train in a realistic fashion. That's something I know that we've talked about with Seth before, and Ben and Chris and everybody on that we've had on the show, is talking about the importance of that kind of training. And that's something that I think that Joe and Jim and the rest of the team at Paragon really focus on, is having the experienced people there who've been through disaster situations, who've been fired in that crucible, to be able to go out and share those experiences and relate some of the things they've learned, so that people are ultimately safer because of this type of awareness and preparedness ahead of time, and being trained to think safety throughout the entire evolution of a rescue event, whether that's an hour or day or weeks. It's something that should never leave our minds, but needs to be appropriately managed with the risks that we have to take on to ourselves. So I hope people will head out and check out Paragon Medical Education Group. Thank them for sponsoring the episodes here at the Disaster Podcast, especially this one, which has been so poignant. So head over to Paragon Medical Group. It's Paragon Med EDU on Twitter, ParagonMedicalGroup.com on the web. And of course, there's links at DisasterPodcast.com as well. And you can always get in touch with them over at our Facebook group. But I'm really great to touch base with everybody. I'm going to forego, having everybody lean in with their individual social media contacts. I'm just going to make sure we have links to the article in the group, and we'll have links to those that have already provided us, because I think we've had everybody here but Sarah on the show in the past. We'll get contact information for everybody and have links to that in the show notes for this episode at disasterpodcast.com. Just a fantastic discussion. And thanks, Kyle and Sam, for taking over the hosting duties for me. I am getting a touch of looks like I might have the flu, actually. So we'll have to deal with that over the next couple of 5 to 10 days, I think. With enough of that, Sam, I just want to kind of wrap up by saying this has been a great topic. I'm so glad you got everybody together for this. And it really is, I think, underlines so many of the things that we work so hard to talk about here on the show.
Yeah, this group is amazing, and they always have something new coming out and something that makes a lot of sense to me. So I guess we could kind of say for this episode, EMS and wilderness safety is not our everyday safety.